From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Through her sensitive and searing short stories, award-winning author Miley Malloy has already made her mark on American letters. She's about to make an even bigger one with her debut novel, Liars and Saints. Miley Malloy takes us through four generations of an American Catholic family, and she challenges us with a difficult question. What happens to a family when mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers lie in the name of love? Up next on Point, Catholic Love, the American Family, Liars and Saints, with Miley Malloy. But first, we begin in Washington with a victory for gay rights. Today, the Supreme Court struck down a Texas ban on sodomy, ruling it an unconstitutional violation of privacy. The 6-3 decision reverses course from a ruling 17 years ago that allowed states to punish homosexuals for what was historically considered deviant sex. Earlier, I spoke with Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University and author of The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America. I asked him about the facts of the Texas case and what legal issues it raised.
These were two gentlemen, an African-American man and a white man, who were found in their home engaged in intimate activities. A neighbor had given a false report of a weapons disturbance. The cops showed up, and they were prosecuted under a Texas sodomy law, which prescribes the conduct that they were engaging in. This is one of only four states that specifically prescribes sodomy when committed by men and men or women and women, but not by heterosexuals. And the law was challenged before the Supreme Court, and in just a path-breaking ruling, the court struck it down this morning. What was so striking about this ruling is that lots of people had expected the court to strike it down on rather narrow grounds. And these were the narrow grounds embraced by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She essentially said, there's nothing wrong with forbidding sodomy, and the court was correct in 1986 when it upheld sodomy laws, but you have to do it even-handedly. In other words, you can't just prescribe it for gays and lesbians. It has to be prescribed for all people across the board. And that rather narrow ruling would have just struck down the law at issue, but it would have left the state free to prescribe sodomy if it did so even-handedly. But the court as a whole embraced far more expansive reasoning. In a majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy and joined by Justices Breyer, Souter, Stevens, and Ginsburg, the court essentially extended the logic of Roe v. Wade farther than many people thought that it would. Roe v. Wade, of course, was the case that recognized a right to abortion in the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And it said that at the core of personal autonomy is the right to define one's own concept of the mystery of human life and existence. It essentially said that personal, intimate, and important activities were protected by the Constitution and that that right of privacy was broad enough to protect a woman's right to choose. Now, this reasoning drives conservatives crazy. They say that this is far too amorphous to be extended across the board. If taken seriously, it would strike down not only abortion laws and now sodomy laws, but adultery laws and prescriptions on bigamy. And in his dissenting opinion, Justice Antonin Scalia really pressed this criticism as strongly as possible. He said it's quite unthinkable that any time that a law is based on moral disapproval, it violates some broad and amorphous notion of personal autonomy. This, he said, will mean the end not only of adultery laws, bigamy laws, but he warned darkly that this was going to mean the judicially imposed recognition of gay marriage as well. And there was just a vigorous, bitter debate among the majority and the dissent about what the source is of this broad right of privacy. And what was so striking about this decision is that Justice Kennedy, a Republican appointee and not ordinarily a fan of expansive interpretation, just extended the logic of Roe as far as it could possibly go. He said that if a decision is important, it's essential to self-definition, to human dignity, then the state can't single out a class of people and prescribe a conduct that comes close to defining their identity. It's really hard to imagine a broader recognition of the autonomy and dignitary rights of gays and lesbians than the court embraced today.
So, Jeffrey, clearly this is good news for gay rights organizations, but also has to be very reassuring to people who have been concerned about what might happen to Roe v. Wade at some point with this court.
In many ways, the debate over Roe v. Wade was really already over. I don't think that any close observers of the court felt that the core of Roe versus Wade was imperiled in any way, it would have taken really a sea change, the retirement of two pro-Roe justices to be replaced by two anti-Roe justices to imperil Roe. What's so interesting about this decision is it takes us so much farther beyond Roe versus Wade. It will certainly empower the gay rights movement to challenge gay marriage before the courts, even though Justice O'Connor tried to say that she wasn't embracing that outcome. The logic is quite expansive in that way. The one interesting question is how much it will inflame and anger the conservative wing. It'll be interesting to see how angry the right is about this decision. There are many conservative organizations that filed briefs in favor of striking down the laws at issue here. And there has been a shift since 1986. Imagine if the court had done what it did today in 1986 and struck down gay rights laws then. One could imagine a dramatic political reaction.
Well, what about that, Jeffrey? I mean, what happens now to the sodomy laws that are still on the books in several states? Are these now vacated?
The logic of them is impossible to reconcile with the court's decision because by embracing a privacy rationale rather than an equality rationale, the court clearly said that the state may not prescribe this intimate activity whether committed by gays or straights. So it's hard to imagine them being sustained.
Now, as we know, there have been no retirement notices announced so far, although we're certainly hearing some rumblings. I wonder what you're hearing and how you would assess the impact on the courts if, for example, Chief Justice Rehnquist or perhaps Justice Sandra Day O'Connor were to step down.
The significance would clearly be quite dramatic because Justice O'Connor in particular, by leading the court to what one could consider a moderate or liberal result in the affirmative action case this week and in the gay rights case today, has quite a different influence than Chief Justice Rehnquist does. Conservatives who are upset about the rather liberal decisions of this week will be especially determined not to encourage the Bush administration to appoint the kind of more moderate justice, perhaps like the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, who's considered to have supported the moderate result in the affirmative action case. Certainly the political climate for a retirement, if it happens, will be as charged as one can imagine. And like everyone else, I'm waiting by with great interest to see what will happen.
Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University and author of The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America. He spoke with us from Washington. Sixteen centuries ago, St. Augustine said, "He who makes the truth comes to the light." Today, the young and talented author Miley Malloy seems to be telescoping the spirit of the Catholic philosopher saint into the pages of her luminous debut novel, Liars and Saints. Miley Malloy is better known for her award-winning short stories set in the American West. But in Liars and Saints, she aims her penetrating insight at four generations of the Santerre family. And she gives us a sweeping parable of the American family, and especially the damage that secrets do when truth, faith, love, and lies collide. Why are loved ones sometimes forced to lie to each other? What effect have secrets had in your family? What role has religion played in resolving the conflict between lies and truth in your life? And is there a little of the liar and the saint in all of us? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Los Angeles is the award-winning author, Miley Malloy. Her debut novel again, Liars and Saints. Good evening and welcome, Miley Malloy.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And I have to confess, first of all, this is such a sprawling novel. There are so many twists and turns among these four generations. I emerged, at least, from it feeling deeply satisfied, as if I had completed a 600-page novel, and then I realized, well, no, actually, this was only 260 pages. And that left me wondering whether this started out as a 600-page novel, and then you just kind of carved and whittled and shaped and really, you know, sculpted this into a much leaner version of that original self.
I probably wrote 600 pages that I then cut, but I wouldn't say it was ever a 600-page novel. I started with two short stories that became, in some form, the first two chapters, and then I sort of expanded it from there and wrote chapters about all the other characters. And then I had, You know, it's actually true. I had so many characters and so many storylines, and I did do a lot of carving to get it down to the one story I wanted to tell and the main characters that I wanted to stay with.
Mm.
So, yes, I hadn't thought of it that way, but it just did.
Well, I wonder if you would start us off with a reading and kind of get us all on the same page so that we can understand who these people are and why they then go on to behave as they do.
Yes. I'll start with a reading from the first chapter, which is from the point of view of a character named Yvette. She's a mother of two in California, in Southern California. She's Catholic. Her husband's name is Teddy. And she, while her husband has been in Korea, he was also a pilot in World War II. But while he's in Korea, she meets a photographer who takes some pictures of her and the children and then makes a pass at her. And she goes to a priest to confess, and the priest tells her that she must tell her husband. So this is where that begins. Her husband's back on leave for Christmas. New Year's Eve, they went to the officers' party, and they didn't get home until 3:30 in the morning, even though Teddy had to leave at 6 to go back to Korea. She'd been pretending he wasn't going to go, but as she took off her shoes and her dress, she knew he was leaving, and she had to tell him. She checked herself in her slip to see if she looked too drunk, and then she went out to the bedroom. "I have something for you before you go," she said. She got the envelope from the night table and pulled out the photographs to lay them on the bed. Teddy sat down to look. He said, "Look at you. You're so pretty." She thought for a second that she could leave the story out. He wasn't angry, and he thought she was pretty. But she went on. "There was a photographer," she said. "I met him at the beach when the girls were swimming, and he offered to take a picture for you, since you were away." Teddy's jaw tightened, and he looked up at her and waited. Yvette had to keep talking, or she would never say it. "He came over and took the picture, and then he wouldn't leave, and he tried to kiss me." There was a pause. "Did he kiss you?" Teddy asked. "I made him stop." "What kind of kiss?" "I don't know," she said. "He grabbed me and kissed me, and then I got away." "So he touched you, too?" Teddy's eyes were hard and intent. "Just to grab me." "Where did he touch you?" Teddy asked, in a voice that was like a threat. "I don't know," she said, "around the waist." Teddy looked back at the picture and studied it. Then he looked up at her again. "Were you drunk?" he asked. She paused, trying to answer. "You were drunk," Teddy said, and his voice was sharp and military, but low enough not to wake the children. "I'd had a drink. I made him a drink and I had one, but I didn't kiss him back. I didn't want him to kiss me. I made him leave then. I sent him away." Teddy stacked the photographs deliberately. "How did you get these prints?" he asked, tapping their edges straight against the envelope on the bed. "He brought them to the house. I didn't let him in." "But you accepted the photographs." "I didn't want him to have them." Her voice sounded desperate, and she tried to control it. "They were for you." "Did you pay him?" "He wouldn't let me." Teddy slid the prints into the envelope and looked at it on his knees. Yvette had her mother's rule with the girls, that they couldn't go to bed angry with each other. If they fought, they had to make up before they went to sleep. Teddy washed up and went to bed without speaking. He had never been short with her before, and now he looked so unforgiving. "Teddy," she said as she got in bed and turned out the light, "you're leaving soon. Don't be angry. I only love you. I never want to see that man again." Teddy rolled over and propped himself on his elbow, and her vision adjusted to the dark so she could see his serious eyes on her. He made love to her then, but he was angry. She could feel it in his body, and he finished with a hard-looking glare over the top of her head. By then, the sun had started to come up. He packed the envelope in his duffel, and before the room was fully light, he was gone.
That was author Miley Malloy reading an excerpt from Liars and Saints. So we pose this question: have you ever been forced to keep a secret from your family? What does the need to protect loved ones from the truth tell us about the American family? And perhaps do you see a little of yourself in Yvette or Teddy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're speaking tonight with the author Miley Malloy about her new novel, Liars and Saints. Miley, I want to reflect for just a moment about the section that we just heard from your novel. Poor Yvette, here she is. She's trying to do the right thing. And then as she tells her husband about the photographer making a pass, if it doesn't ruin her life, it certainly greatly affects her marriage.
Mm-hmm. And changes their relationship. But she is really, I think, trying to do what she thinks she's supposed to do. And I think in a lot of cases in this book, people are doing the thing they think they're supposed to do at the time and the thing they think will be best. And in this case, it's what the priest thinks is best. And it turns out not to be probably the best idea.
Mm. And it tells us so much about Yvette, too, because clearly she wants to be a good Catholic, and then she goes against pretty much every rule of the church there is. She lies, she hides the truth about a child who's born out of wedlock. What were you trying to tell us about this woman's internal contradictions?
You were talking about a scene that happens later when she decides that it's best not to do as the priest would advise her to do, and she lies to her husband about this child. I think what Yvette's doing is sort of developing this private and passionate relationship to God that is separate from what the church would tell her to do. What I like about Yvette is the sort of strength of mind she has, both in terms of her faith, which I think takes real strength of mind in the 20th century in America to have, and also in terms of her sort of intense willpower to stick to this decision she's made. And, of course, it turns out not to be great for everyone else in the family. But I sort of like the strength of her, regardless of how that strength gets channeled.
Hmm. And we invite our listeners to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, if there are any secrets from your family you'd like to share. And what about that, Miley? Did you really set out here to tell a story about secrets in families, and these characters were the vehicle for that, or did they sort of take on a life of their own as you were writing about them?
They absolutely took on a life of their own. I started with these two stories, and I sort of thought, well, this is a story about sexual jealousy. And then the next story I wrote is from Teddy's point of view and sort of explains where some of the force of his response comes from. And then as I started sort of teasing out what might happen to these people over the years, the secret seemed to be a way to write about the way families do kind of repeat things, regardless of whether they want to, and often in spite of their wanting not to. And how, people who are supposed to be open and love each other keep necessary secrets from each other in order to sort of define themselves and have a private life, and also sort of hurt each other by keeping secrets.
Mm. And each of the characters also seems to be very much a creature of his or her time. And I'm wondering how difficult it was for you to create someone like Yvette, and particularly her life in the 40s and 50s. I don't think I'm giving away any secrets here when I say you are clearly so much younger than that.
I spent a lot of time thinking about them, and I did some research and so that I could fill in details. But the historical moment was really important to me. So I did sort of spend a lot of time thinking about what that might be, but it's also not that removed from my generation.
Certainly you could imagine it. And you also get very nicely inside Teddy's head, as you mentioned a moment ago, particularly when he was serving in the Navy during World War II and was a very jealous husband at that point. Would you do another reading that shows that about his character?
Yes, absolutely. He's on a Navy aircraft carrier. He's a fighter pilot. And this comes after the section I read before in which he's been very jealous about Yvette later in their lives. And so this goes back to sort of find out where his perspective is coming from. Chapter 2. In the summer of 1945, in the middle of the Pacific, the war took on a strange stillness. Teddy flew out every day on patrol, looking for submarines that weren't there, and returned to the carrier to file his reports, maintain his equipment, and think. The rumor said they were preparing for a land invasion of Japan. Pilots were never fully briefed in case of capture, but Teddy could make guesses based on the training exercises, and the invasion rumors sounded right. He played gin rummy in the wardroom lounge with a pilot named Rand, who said the Japanese would fight to the death and never surrender, and kill themselves rather than be captured. Teddy wondered if he would do that, but guessed he would be shot out of the air before he had to decide. Their carrier was a small CVE, a jeep carrier, with a runway so short they used a hydraulic catapult to shoot the planes off the flight deck, as if firing them from a cannon. The pilots couldn't hold the controls because they might pull them when the G-force hit, so they locked their elbows to their sides with an open left hand over the throttle and an open right on the stick and pressed their heads back. Then the explosive charge made the plane into a bullet, and the acceleration nailed their stomachs to the backs of their seats, and they took hold of the controls. But there was always a moment before the impact, a moment of absolute stillness and blue sky above, when the shock was imminent. The catapult crew was set up and ready below, and that long second was perfectly still. It was how Teddy imagined death, the waiting moment, the blue sky, something surprising and expected about to come. What troubled him most about the possibility of death was that it would leave his wife alone. Yvette had an over-the-shoulder smile like a pin-up girl, and when the smile caught him right, it made it hard for Teddy to breathe. She had a chipped tooth on the right, a tiny chip you only noticed up close, and Teddy loved it. Even more, he loved the smile that forgot the chip was there. He wanted to kiss her teeth when he thought of it. She was down from Canada, like he was, and came from Catholics, like he did, and he felt he knew her in his blood and had always known her. It hurt him to be away. For 3 months in Santa Barbara, man and wife, they had been happy. There was always music playing somewhere, and Yvette had danced him off his feet. If Teddy hadn't kept dancing, she would have danced someone else off his feet. She had a look of pure happiness when she was dancing, her over-the-shoulder smile coming under his arm as she turned. The thought of her turning and the smile appearing ran through Teddy's mind on the long days of waiting. It made him hate the stretch of Pacific between them. There was so little to do on the carrier and so much time that his brain turned on the topic of Yvette like gears that couldn't connect, had nothing to take their energy, and so spun on and on. 3 months wasn't long enough for a girl like Yvette to feel married. She was so used to being adored, her father and brothers and uncles all in love with her, that the thought of her alone in California was a terrible thing.
So nicely done, Miley. And it's interesting to note that while Teddy was also Catholic, he's clearly not nearly as Catholic as his wife is. What are you telling us here? Is Catholic guilt really different from all the other varieties? I mean, would this story have been completely different if the family had been Unitarian or Jewish or Buddhist or some other religion?
I imagine it would. I'm interested in the things people feel passionately about, and Catholicism is obviously one of them. And I think the way it takes individuals with their own histories and does sort of strange things with them, and, you know, sometimes wonderful things with them, is really interesting. I do think it would be different if it were a Unitarian family, although not that different, because it's still a story about an American family, and you can imagine other people doing some of what they do.
Hmm. Were you raised Catholic?
I wasn't. I was raised in Montana in the 70s, and I wasn't really raised anything.
I was going to say, that's an interesting answer. I was raised in Montana. Well, your Catholic friends who have read this, do they say, yes, indeed, you got it right, or are there some subtleties that perhaps they might have missed?
They seem to say I got it right, and there's, you know, I certainly know many Catholics, and although this is by no means my family story, there are Catholics in my family, and I've had friends who have either been in the seminary or considered it, and I read a lot of books. I read Abelard and Eloise and Cardinal Newman's book and the autobiography of St. Therese of Lisieux, so I felt like I spent a lot of time thinking about a thing I knew something about and knew something about the sensibility of without having really the training.
Clearly did your research. Let's bring one of your readers into the conversation from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I have a comment. You don't know a thing about the Catholic Church. I'm Catholic, have been forever. The girl, I don't feel sorry for poor Yvette. what I was amazed at was the strength of her selfishness. She used that priest as her cop-out to do exactly what she wanted to do. She was selfish. She hurt her husband in order to unload her guilt. That's not what the Catholic Church teaches, and I don't know of a priest in a confessional who would have said, tell your husband.
Really?
And I've been Catholic for 62 years.
All right.
Yes,
Kathy,
really.
Kathy, what do you think the priest would have told her then?
I don't know. You'd have to be Catholic and go to confession with your sin.
So he would not have said, tell your husband.
Probably he would say, sin, you know, you're forgiven, leave and sin no more. But if she said that she was going to do it again, well, he wouldn't give her absolution. He would say, you're forgiven, sin and do no more. But he would never say, go and tell your husband and make him feel like a shithead.
But even under the notion of that there shouldn't be secrets in marriage, I mean, he wasn't doing it maliciously in the book.
Who? Yvette?
No, the priest, when he gave her this advice.
No,
I mean, he
priest
was...
would say that. I know many, many priests. No priest would say that. She did that to relieve herself of her guilt. She wasn't thinking about her husband.
Okay, Kathy, we take your point. Miley, what do you think?
Oh, that there are so many individuals and that... So many individuals give different advice, obviously, and it's not always in the spirit of the church, and it's always, not always, you know, taken in the spirit that's given. So I absolutely take her point, and I still think that people do many things that we wouldn't want or expect them to do.
Hmm. Let me ask you a different question. That is the choice you made within a very limited amount of space and pages to write about four generations of the same family. Obviously, a very broad view. What did that allow you to do that perhaps just telling one generation's story would not have?
I touched on this briefly before, but to sort of watch how things play out in a family and how people want to do things differently than the generation before them did, but what they do is informed by the way they were raised and the circumstances of their sort of historical moment in the country and historical moment in the family, and sort of to watch how that happens.
Hmm.
And to see sort of what the second half of the 20th century does to a family and how you know, the changes that have happened in the past 60 years, you know, affect the family.
Did you have a favorite character?
Oh, that's a hard question. This won't mean anything to anyone who's only been listening, but I like Gail and I like Jamie a lot. I spent a lot of time with Jamie, who's a character who comes later in the book, and I really liked writing that character.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot happens to your characters, to say the least, but as several reviewers have noted, you are able to pull this all off without it sounding like soap opera. And I wonder, were there moments as you were writing when you thought, oh, you know, I better be a little careful here because we're getting into Oprah land?
There was actually one or two other things that happened that I cut out because I thought there's no more things to happen.
This is too much.
and it's funny, it wasn't until I had people trying to describe the plot, like my editor was trying to describe the plot to someone, and she said, and I realized it sounded like a soap opera, but it doesn't feel like it as you're reading it. And so that, it certainly didn't feel like it as I was writing it. I think because, you know, over a period of 60 years, things like this do happen to a family.
Hmm.
And, you know, maybe not to this extreme, but you know, certainly families are dealt blows over a period of a long period of time.
Hmm. Let's go back to our phone lines now to Cambridge, Massachusetts. James is with us. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I guess I was raised Catholic, so from my perspective, I was just listening to your previous caller saying that she can't believe that any priest would ever advise to divulge such kind of stuff to their spouse. When I was 19 years old, my mother came to me. She was working at a Catholic missionary, and my parents were both Catholic, and we went to church all the time and stuff like that, and she asked me my opinion on explaining to my father that she was in love with one of the brothers that she worked with at the Catholic missionary.
Wow.
The brother was in love with her. And I told her, I was 19, I didn't really know what to do. as far as that went, as far as what divulged, but she also told me that she had sought the counsel of a Catholic priest who told her that the best thing was forthrightness and honesty, and that she should tell her husband about the way she felt. And she did, and my father lost it and just about went mental. He did sort of go mental. He just didn't get committed. But that was the advice of the priest. That was exactly what the priest said. Go right up and tell him.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear of your experience, James, but I appreciate your sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
We all have opportunities to grow from the things that are presented to us in life, so our choices to experience it and get better or worse. So I have to look at it like it's an opportunity as opposed to just a negative.
Good point. Thank you, James.
Absolutely.
I wonder if that's something that you're finding is happening a lot to you these days, Miley. I mean, as you go around the country, are people confiding these long-held, deep family secrets to you?
Some. I wish they would more. I have found that people, having read the book, start to remember that they've known of something like this happening. The sort of incident, I don't want to give too much away,
right,
but the baby who is passed off as someone else's baby. I have found that is an experience that people have had and or know of someone who's had. So I don't think it's as uncommon as it might seem.
And one of the really incredible moments in the book to me, I have to tell you, was when one of the characters who was involved in this lie went to his mother and said, okay, what's the story? And she lied to him again.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I'm so glad you told me the truth. I mean, you have to think that sort of thing must eat away at your soul in some way.
Yeah, that scene breaks my heart, too. I mean, I hate to say that. It sounds self-indulgent. But I do think, you know, that this happens, and people do keep secrets from each other over long periods of time.
Can it be a good thing?
I do think, you know, I think we want the people we love to be open with us, but I also think that obviously parents keep certain things secret from children, and children keep certain things secret from parents, and siblings to keep secrets from each other, and it's how, you know, like I said earlier, we have a private life and we define ourselves, and I just think this is an instance in which it's sort of gotten out of control. And I do think that Yvette thought she was doing the best thing at the time, and that, you know, that everyone is sort of, they're decent people acting decently, and still doesn't always work out. They muddle through.
We're talking this hour about Liars and Saints with debut novelist Miley Malloy. Is the Santerre story a modern American story? What effect do family lies have when they're passed on from generation to generation? How can families find salvation from their own lies? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Liars and Saints with novelist Miley Malloy. What does the need to protect loved ones from the truth tell us about the American family? Do you perhaps see a little of yourself in Yvette or Teddy Santerre? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go now to Wisconsin, Menasha, Wisconsin, in fact, where Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Hi. My question to you was, as I'm researching my own family tree, I went back about four generations and found just many interesting things about women in my family, and I'm disappointed that people weren't able to share those things, because the things that the knowledge that I've obtained through other channels has been very enlightening to me.
And was that because they had secrets, you think, or they just didn't think their stories were important enough to remember and pass on?
I think there was a bit of shame, and you know, just especially with the women on the side of my family, just, you know, just being wanting to be educated and coming from different countries, and that being unpopular.
And how have you found out about the things that they hadn't shared?
Just through my research and getting in contact with older relatives, things that my mother didn't know.
Wow.
And it was very interesting.
That is interesting.
Well, thanks for sharing your story, Carol, and I wish you luck as you continue to uncover the family stories. Miley, I want to ask you, a few moments ago you referred to the fact that the novel actually began as a couple of short stories, and of course you're well known for your previous collection of short stories, Half in Love, which did very well indeed. What's the difference in terms of how you write a novel versus how you craft a short story, other, obviously, than the length?
Well, the length was a big one. I mean, when I set out to do this, I didn't know if I could write a novel. I'd never written anything that was longer than 15 pages, really. And so the idea of having a story be able to sustain itself over the length of a novel was sort of daunting. For me, putting those two stories together so that I had, 30 or 40 pages to start with was very reassuring. And then knowing that I could open those up, because in a short story, you have so little time and you don't get to really spend that much time with, minor characters in the story or, the history of the people in the story. So it's sort of wonderful to be able to expand and take time and look into things that you don't get to look into in a short story. So I think my sensibility is still to be as efficient as possible about doing that. The length of time you get in a novel was also really wonderful, and I would really like to do it again.
And is your writing, which has been often described as spare, do you do that deliberately because you really want to force the reader to bring his own or her own imagination to the process instead of kind of spelling everything out for them?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I want to be clear, and I want to sort of say what happens. And I think it ends up being spare. And I'm not ever sure. I don't ever think of it as spare, I guess, because I think I'm sort of saying everything that needs to be said. But I guess I don't know how to answer very well.
Well, we'll let you reflect on it. And also, thank you very much, Miley Malloy, for joining us from Los Angeles.
Thank you so much.
Her new novel is Liars and Saints, and her previous collection of short stories is Half in Love. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, On Point's movie maven takes us all to summer camp. This is On Point. It's summer at last, and time for family vacations and barbecues for the adults and for the kids. If they're lucky, time for summer camp. Nowadays, there's a camp for just about everyone. Baseball camp, gymnastics camp, space camp, fat camp, even a nudist camp for kids. And, of course, Hollywood has always capitalized on the fun, frivolity, and pain of summer camp. Our news analyst Jack Beatty spoke with On Point's movie maven Garen Daly about some of the best summer camp movies.
Well, it's 7:05 in the a.m., and I'm Trooper Harrison.
Ah! I'm your head counselor.
And this is my wake-up show. I'll be coming at you every morning. About this time, hoping to make your summer camp experience the best available in this price range. Of course, across the lake, over at Camp Mohawk, they won't be getting up for another hour or so. And when they do, they'll be awakened by servants bearing croissants and cafe au lait. But over here at Camp North Star, this morning we're going to be having a delicious gruel breakfast. And don't forget to ask for seconds, because it's all the gruel you can eat.
Whether it was dining on croissant at Camp Mohawk or slurping gruel at Camp North Star, summer camp has always furnished the high and low of school break for many boys and girls. Summer camp is swimming in the lake, campfires, wiener roasts, poison ivy, and puppy love. Hollywood can't resist going to camp. And to review some camp movies, we're joined by Garen Daly, a film critic, artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Mass., and On Point's movie maven. Welcome once again, Garen Daly.
Hi, Jack. I'm sitting here with my compass and backpack, and I'm ready to go to camp.
Good for you. Well, you know, these movies appeal to the adolescent in all of us, or at least to the failed boy in all of us.
Well, you know, the clip we just heard was from Meatballs with Bill Murray, and I have to say that that's one of my favorite films. It has, you know, a lot of the great underlying themes of all the camp films. It's like the hero's arc in a hero action film. You've got usually somebody going into a strange situation. Mm-hmm. They're being challenged for the first time. Their resources are being called upon. They usually fail at first, and then they come back, reassess themselves, and then go out and win the day. And that could be beating the Camp Mohawk across the lake there in Meatballs or some other challenge that they are faced.
And this challenge is defined often in comic terms. These are fundamentally gross comedies, aren't they?
They are gross comedies, but again, the themes are pretty solid in terms of what these young adolescents are going through. They are being challenged for the first time, and, you know, they are dealing with, you know, conflict. And in the movies, there are things like the ghost story, the letter from home, or actually getting the news that they are going to be going to camp for the first time.
I've been coming here since I was 10 years old. You want to know why? Because Camp Hope is the fun way to lose weight. Right, guys?
It's a fat camp. Are you crazy? No way. I'm not going to a camp with a bunch of fat loads.
Jerry?
Now, that's not kind, Jerry.
We're doing this for your own good.
You're fatter than I am. Why don't you go to the camp?
You show your father some respect.
First, I think we should have a little powwow, and we will call you with our decision later.
I'll give you my decision right now. I'm not going.
Oh, boy. Now, you've been looking into the genre, not merely of the movies, but of summer camp. This is an institution in American life, but also a big business.
Yeah, it's a big business. And, you know, Jerry Garner, who we just heard there from Heavyweights, a 1995 film, kind of embodies a lot of the things that are going on with the industry of summer camp that is happening right now. It's an $11 billion a year industry. There are something like 10,000 different kinds of camps in the United States. And the genre of the film is a relatively recent genre. Mm-hmm. It's something that just seems to have come across in the last 20 or 30 years. It's amazing. When I was doing some research on the internet, I pulled up summer camps, and there were summer camps for everything. You know, sports camps, regular, you know, physical mm-hmm. exercise, learning how to be in the woods kind of camps, engineer camps, computer camps, fat camps, and even counterintelligence camps, military school. You can learn about being a spy at a camp at the age of 12. What is that saying about our culture?
I daren't ask. Now, what else have you got for us here?
Well, you know, I think I wanted to go back to like what I consider to be one of the first of the modern camp films. And we're going back to 1961 to Disney with Haley Mills and the Parent Trap. It's a story about two twins who were separated at birth who are meeting at camp for the first time. And they hate each other until they're thrown together. Mm-hmm. And in this, main themes of the summer camp film, meeting new friends.
Where did he come from?
Outer space?
No.
I'm from Boston.
Ooh, Boston.
Where's your home?
California.
Oh, I've seen movies of California. Is it a nice place to live?
Sensational. We got a ranch out in Carmel. We got a lake.
You know, you could practically fall right out of the front door and go swimming anytime you want.
That is the voice, if I'm not mistaken, of Haley Mills.
Yeah, and both
from
roles.
The Parent Trap.
You got it.
Who's in that movie along with Brian Keith and Maureen O'Hara, who's gone on a number of these summer camps. I mean, Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation, as I recall. She's in that, too.
Well, it's great seeing Maureen O'Hara on screen. She's always terrific.
Oh,
but,
yeah, absolutely.
But again, what we're talking about here with the film is that here they are, these two twins who don't know that they're actually twins, actually hate each other, and then they meet together at the camp and they become great buddies, and in that buddyship, that friendship, they find out that they're actually twin sisters, and thus the plot moves forward very quickly. But it's one of the very first of the films that dealt with summer camp as a place for meeting and a kind of culture being exchanged.
And talking about culture being exchanged, the ghost story is a summer tradition, isn't it?
The ghost story is a perfect example of that. The ghost story is always said around the campfire. And the campfire is sort of like the town hall. And the town hall is also the place where the lore is passed on, the tradition is passed on. And that's an important part of these films, knowing that the older generation is teaching the younger generation those values that they need to pass on.
Chief, can you tell us a big story?
When a young brave was ready to become a warrior, it was here that he was called by the wise men and the elders. If he had faith in the Great One, the knife would not cut him. If he had courage, true courage, the rock would not break him. If the brave was pure of heart, the arrow could not catch him. And that was called the ceremony of the blade, the stone, and the arrow.
Like in our culture, paper, rock, scissors.
That's a scene from Ernest Goes to Camp, 1987, one of a series of Ernest movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was Jim Varney, the late, great Jim Varney. And those were wonderful, oddball, off-the-map kind of movies that inspired or kind of made everyone laugh for a whole generation.
Now, you've got one more here, and this refers to a big moment at summer camp, the letter from home.
Yeah, before email, we had to sit down and write letters. And in Adam's Family Values, Christina Ritchie is Wednesday at a camp. She is totally outcast here, but she's getting the letter from home, the dreaded letter from home.
Mail call! Adams!
Oh, no. What is it? Harper. This is unspeakable. This is the worst thing that has ever happened in the history of human events. Uncle Fester is getting married.
A wedding? But that's great news!
To who? The nanny. Get out of the cabin. I mean, I'll kill myself. The help? I think their whole family's like some weird medical experiment. I think they're like circus people. What did you say?
Pampers!
Group hug!
Adam's Family Values, 1993, and I see with the late Raul Julia.
Yeah, I mean, I love those films, and the humor in it is wonderful. But did you notice that there was two themes going on there? There's one about the letter from home. There's also this kind of class distinction that's going on. And I think what we're seeing in the summer camp movies is that it's no longer the province of the wealthy people. It is also plain, regular, working class people who are going to summer camp to try and get some of those agrarian values that we wanted to instill into our children, the fact that they should be mentally, physically, and morally upright. And I think that's what summer camp it tries to do, and these summer camp movies also try and show us.
And do we have any of these movies coming out this summer?
Yeah, actually, we have one out that's out right now that it's not quite summer camp. It's about juvenile detention camp, but it has all the themes. It's a wonderful film called Holes, and another film that just won the Provincetown International Film Festival Audience Award. It's a documentary. It's called Camp. It's about kids going to camp in upstate New York for arts and music and stuff like that. Both are highly rated and recommended.
And, you know, these movies take the anxiety, or at least they mitigate the anxiety of going to camp for kids, don't they? They see the movie, they laugh, they realize, hey, I can do this.
You know, I sometimes think that a lot of kids see these films and get terrified.
Thank you, Garen Daly.
You're welcome, Jack.
Garen Daly is a film critic, the artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. He spoke with our news analyst, Jack Beattie. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.